Good evening, welcome to Tuesday's Sport at 7. Champions League soccer, professional cycling and a journey through Victorian sports journalism all contribute to form tonight's offerings. After their brilliance against Barcelona, Glasgow Celtic are tonight in the city where they won the European Cup 45 years ago. We'll be hearing from Roddy Forsyth in Lisbon ahead of tonight's action. And with Manchester United already advanced to the last 16, we'll focus on what might lie in store for a seemingly under pressure Chelsea side against Juventus. Over the weekend, he medalled twice at Track Cycling's World Cup. Yesterday, he confirmed a deal to race professionally for one of America's big cycling teams. We'll be hearing from the Irish Olympian Martin Irvine. And in an era of 24-hour news cycles and endless coverage of the beautiful game, we're set to be transported back to the 19th century to speak to the editor of a new anthology of soccer writing from the time of the game's emergence. Our email address tonight, sport@7@rte.ie. At RTE Sport at 7, we'll find us on Twitter. If you'd like to text us from the north, send the word studio, followed by your message to 80889. From the Republic, our number 51551.
Sport at 7 with Damien O'Mara on RTE Radio 1 in association with AIB, supporting clubs, supporting communities.
The makeup of the knockout stages for this season's Champions League will continue to take shape tonight with match day 5 getting underway in groups E, F, G and H. We have two results already in. Bate Borisov beaten 2-0 at home by Lille in group F. In group G, Spartak Moscow beaten 3-0 at home by Barcelona. No Aidan McGeady, he has returned to training from injury though. That result, a very notable result for Glasgow Celtic fans who might be listening to the programme tonight. Celtic away to Benfica. Team news is just in. Forster in goal. Back four of Lustig, Wilson, Ambrose and Matthews. Ledley and Wanyama in midfield, flanked by Scott Brown and Charlie Mulgrew, and Samaras and Hooper lead the line up front. So some injury concerns. Not relevant. Players starting that Neil Lennon implied might not start. A big game tonight for Celtic. Roddy Forsyth is in Lisbon. And that result between Spartak Moscow and Barcelona means that Celtic's destiny to advance to the knockout stages is starting to come a little bit cleaner.
Yes, the problem that was in Neil Lennon's mind today was that if Spartak Moscow had been able to do a Celtic on Barcelona and had won in the Luzhniki Stadium, the section would have been blown wide open going into the last games. However, Spartak Moscow are now out of the reckoning. If Celtic beat Benfica tonight, they're in the last 16. If Celtic come out of the Estadio de Luz with a scoring draw, they're in the last 16. If Benfica win, conversely, it will go to the final games, but Benfica are away to Barcelona. Celtic are at home to Spartak Moscow, and in those circumstances you'd have to think it would favour Celtic, but it would be a very sweaty night. So best if Celtic can do their work here in Portugal this evening.
Are we now into bonus territory for the club? Surely they haven't budgeted for knockout stages of the Champions League, have they?
They hadn't budgeted for anything after Christmas. They had hoped that they would get into the Champions League group stage. That wasn't budgeted for either, let me tell you. So what we're talking about here is a bonus in terms of cash of something in the region of 15 to 20 million euros. Probably more than that by the time you take in the three home gates. There'll be capacity gates at Celtic Park. So this is a bonanza. And here's another one for you. If Neil Lennon wins tonight, it's his 100th victory as a manager.
But what a season it has been for him from a personal point of view. The notable landmark marks keep coming for him.
Yes, they do indeed. We had the very first title win Celtics under his management back in May. Then we had the first back-to-back victories in Europe. That, of course, occurred in the qualifiers. That was the first back-to-back victories in Europe since he was a player under Martin O'Neill. And then we've had away victories, of course, in, if you calculate them all, the victories in Helsinki, in Helsingborg, in Moscow. Really quite extraordinary. The defeat of Barcelona 2 weeks ago. If Celtic can do this tonight, here in, of all the European cities that matters most to them, it would be an extraordinary achievement.
And they really have invoked the spirit of Lisbon and the spirit of the Lions from 67 this week. Haven't they?
Yes, they brought some of the Lions with them on the team plane, and I was sitting next to the European Cup. It had two seats to itself, much to the chagrin of the two guys who were supposed to be in those seats and had to be moved elsewhere. There was a suggestion we were going to bring them in the hold, but the Cup was on display today at the Estadio Nacional. That's the stadium that Celtic beat Inter Milan in 1967, and for 2 hours Celtic fans could queue up and stand where Billy McNeil stood when he became the first British captain to hold that trophy, and they could have their pictures taken, and there were a good number of Irish fans there, I can tell you, and they'll all be looking at themselves on the website gallery, which I gather will go up on the Celtic official website later this week.
Very briefly before I let you go, we shouldn't forget that this is effectively cup final territory for Benfica tonight, and they will come out, they need to win.
They've got to win. If they lose tonight, they're in. They would go into the Europa League, but their chances of making the Champions League would be gone. They know that they must either get a goalless draw to stay level with Celtic, and the head-to-head would be absolutely even, or they must win to go ahead of Celtic and give themselves a fighting chance. But remember, they have to go to the Nou Camp. The only problem for Celtic's point of view is that Barcelona might now play a weakened team.
Roddy, enjoy the game.
Thank you.
Roddy Forsyth there in Lisbon. The omen's good for Celtic. Their previous appearances in the last 16 have both come after games, or after group games, which involved Benfica being in their group. So the omen's good there. Elsewhere in terms of British sides in action, Galatasaray entertaining Manchester United tonight. Juventus against Chelsea. We'll talk about the Juve-Chelsea game in a moment. But Manchester-based reporter Dominic McGuinness joins us. Dominic, to have a quick look through the Manchester United lineup for tonight. Good news for Phil Jones, who's back. An opportunity for Fergie to give Butner and Powell an outing. And I have to admit that I think at least five of the Manchester United subs I've never heard of before. So it's an opportunity for Fergie, with advancement already secured, to blood the young guns.
Yeah, and that was always the way. I mean, he always has ambitions to stay within the title leaders in terms of the Premier League race. That's what he always sets out to do. If he's in touch with the leaders in the Premier League at Christmas time, everything is well. And if Champions League qualification is secured, then fine. Now, of course, that is the case. That's why it's no surprise that he's going to blood some of the young kids. He's going to use the squad that he has, the Champions League squad. And interesting that Carrick will play at the back again tonight alongside Jones, who's back for his first appearance after a long layoff. And Lindegaard gets a shot ahead of De Gea again. And, there is still lots of experience in there with Anderson and Fletcher, who'll be in the holding positions. Powell, a rare start, but of course he's one for the future. That's always been the case as far as this season's concerned. Welbeck, Cleverley, Hernandez also in there. So, it's the kind of team that he feels will be able to do a job in Istanbul and won't be too overawed, and then some of the kids off the bench potentially as well to be blooded. So it's not a surprising side.
It's a difficult situation though, and it's one that Fergie has criticised other clubs for in the past. The playing of what is, without doubt, a weakened side when there are still valuable points to play for in the group.
It is a contentious one because, of course, the destiny of other sides can in many ways rest on what Manchester United do and what other teams do when they're at this stage. But, you ask Sir Alex Ferguson, who he's really bothered about, and he's only bothered about one thing, and that's Manchester United. So he's going to do what's best for his club, and he really is not going to lose any sleep. If anyone's going to give him any flack about team selection, he's just going to say, it's a squad. My squad was there. It was named well ahead of this. I can use whoever I want on that list, and that's exactly what he's doing.
No Fernando Torres in the starting lineup for Chelsea away to Juventus tonight. Is it feasible they could become the first champions to get knocked out in the group stages?
Well, it certainly is a huge, huge night, Damien. I mean, in terms of Chelsea and what they have to do in Turin, it's about not getting beaten. And it's a big call from, obviously, Roberto Di Matteo. I mean, last season, AVB, just 9 months ago, he made a big call when he dropped Lampard and Ashley Cole from the side in Napoli. And ultimately, in many ways, that was his downfall, because that was pretty much one of his last actions as Chelsea boss. But I think Di Matteo making a bold statement like that, he's saying that, I think, obviously, one goal in seven from Torres isn't good enough. And the fact that only two wins in the last seven as Chelsea, even though they are defending European champions, he's got to do something to shake things up. And if Torres is suffering a little bit, I'm not sure this is going to help his confidence. But if he needs to leave it out, he's got to do what he thinks is right for the side. They've got plenty of talent in there anyway. So Chelsea can come through this, not get beaten in a side Pirlo-inspired in Turin. Then, again, all things will be good and it will be a well-made decision. But, of course, as we know, as history will prove, a big, big call.
Dominic, thanks for joining us. Dominic McGuinness there. Big night for Di Matteo. Never good when you hear the owner Abramovich turning up at the training ground. It is cycling next, where yesterday it was confirmed that Irish Olympian track cyclist Martin Irvine has signed to race the roads with the American United Healthcare team for the 2013 season in what is, without a shadow of a doubt, a big step up in his career. By his own admission, a 13th place finish in the Omnium at the London Olympics was a disappointing end to his campaign. But Martin has plenty of successful days on the track in particular to reflect upon, not least two silver medals at the World Cup in Glasgow the weekend just gone. Let's hear from the man himself. Two silvers and a big pro deal sign. Not a bad weekend's work.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say it's a pretty rare thing to happen to me. It's kind of all happened at once, if you like. It's been a long few years of chipping away, and then it finally all flooded in the one weekend. So it was a great experience.
This news of the signing with United Healthcare, does it give you a fresh impetus?
Yeah, definitely. It's another spark. It's very monotonous cycling in it itself, you know. So you need certain goals to kind of keep your chin up and keep chasing something, you know. So this is just a new lease of life, yeah. So it's a really nice feeling to have, you know, bigger goals, you know, than the normal to kind of set myself, you know. This is all kind of a new challenge for me.
Did you feel you were in a bit of a rut?
To be honest, this year after the Olympics and all, I was in a bit of a downer, and that's the way it felt, you know. I'm just going through the same motions and not getting anywhere. So, you know, with the help of Grace, my fiance, she kind of kept giving me a kick in the backside, and, you know, and it kind of keeps you getting up every morning doing the same thing, and then finally it just kind of clicked. So it's a nice feeling, you know. It's kind of justified a lot of hard work.
But at 27, do you start to think that an opportunity like this, despite the great talent you have, is going to pass you by?
Yeah, definitely. You know, this year, all that sort of thing went through my head, you know. I kind of had my dream of the Olympics kind of launching me and doing whatever, and then I had one of the worst days on the bike, you know. You know, it just shows you it's not all said and done on the big goals, you know. If you keep going through it, it's like stepping stones, you know. So I'm just lucky to have them to keep going, you know.
Did you ever consider walking away from it?
Honestly, probably a couple of times a year. Like, I'd get like that, my head would take over me, like, you know, and when you're tired and, you know, it's hurting or whatever, you talk yourself out of it, or you do your best you can, you know. But then it's a bug, like, you know, cycling. It's kind of once you're bitten, you're mad for it. So it kind of, after a few miserable days, you kind of refocus again, and then, you know, for me anyway, I kind of refocus and get stuck in again with the same kind of hard work, you know. And it's kind of a good feeling. The results this weekend there just kind of proved that I'm doing it right, you know, and I'm not like out of my depth. So I'm happy enough that I kept going. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about United Healthcare. This is a major operation you're signing up with, and it's a fantastic vote of confidence in your ability.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm overwhelmed, like, by the kind of the team setup, you know. For me, it's mad. Like, it's just such a privilege to kind of get the opportunity, you know. And I have to just be as serious as ever this year and just commit to doing what I'm asked, doing the best job I can, you know, and kind of prove myself.
And what would success be?
Well, I suppose, you know, just establishing yourself on the pro circuit. You know, it's a hard world to kind of, I'm no way a team leader and I'm thinking like that, so I'm going to rock in and do what I'm told, and as long as the team's happy and do what they want, keep them happy, and hopefully next year carry on and do more, and maybe then I get a bit of free rein to see what I can do, you know.
And how much do you know of where you'll be based? There's been talk of some European races, but will you predominantly be in the States?
Good question. I mean, I looked at the kind of the race program, and it's probably 50-50 Europe to America, the races I have, you know. So I kind of pitched to them, like, I'm going to a training camp in a few weeks, and I said, you look at me, tell me what you think, and then I'm happy to do what you want, you know. So I'm pretty much open to that.
People will be aware of the success you've had, and you've come to the attention of a lot of people because of your track achievements. How easy or how difficult is it to transfer that to road racing?
It takes a bit more training, you know. I think the likes of the disciplines that I do, it's pretty easy to transfer, you know. But more, you know, you do need to really get specific coming up to certain events. You know, you couldn't rock in from doing a track race and then go and do well on a big, like, stage race in the road, you know. But the kind of the power it puts, transfer, you know, you just need to build up a bit of endurance before you go racing, or slightly more power before you go track racing, you know. But the engine's kind of basically the same, you know. Just needs tuned up in different ways.
But you seem to strike me as the type of fella who, when there's a challenge set before you and you're re-energised by this now, you're going to, you know, go into it all guns blazing to prove yourself and to mix it with the best.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm kind of good at picking goals and kind of, you know, obviously I keep going back to the Olympics. That was one I kind of missed by a long shot. But I'm pretty good at just meeting goals and ticking the boxes, you know. So there's no fast track to it. It's just months of just knuckling down and doing, you know, just aiming for a certain thing. And I kind of, I just keep doing what I'm doing, and I seem to be doing it right, you know.
Well, then, in terms of long-term goals, where are you starting to look? Is the Commonwealth Games in 2014 back in Glasgow on the agenda, or something you're looking at much further down the track?
I think, you know, it's definitely in there. It's kind of intermediate goals, I would say. You need something every other year to kind of keep you chasing, you know, because the Olympics is obviously the biggest one, but it's a long shot, you know, so you need something to keep you focused. Get to that one and then pick the, you know, I've got to the games in good form, then I would kind of see how that goes and then target the Olympic Games after the Commonwealth Games or something like that, you know. But I'm going to go with the flow with the pro side of things this year and see how I can balance things, you know. So it's kind of exciting, like, it's new to me, kind of doing this for a job, you know, and for Ireland as well, so it'll be an interesting mix.
Does it take some of the burden of even just living a day-to-day life off you as well? Because in any form of amateur sport, the difficulty in making ends meet and the difficulty in combining training with being able to put food on the table is quite a challenge.
Yeah, that's the hardest part, probably being amateur. You know, there's that sense of you need to perform, like, you know, and I've been doing the bare minimum, like, to kind of keep myself living, to kind of achieve certain goals, you know. I've been always in the bottom end of the scale, but now I've kind of proved that I'm kind of worth the money, you know, and investment from the sports council. It's kept me living, to be honest, you know. And it's good to kind of give it back too, like, they're not just supporting me for no reason, you know. So that's kind of a nice, you know, it just feels good, like, to kind of prove that I'm not a waste of money.
Did you have other options to go pro, or was this, you know, the best offer or the most appealing offer that was on the table?
Well, because I'm a trackie, it was, to be fair to Mike and United Healthcare, he's taking a gamble on me, you know, and I'm, you know, I owe him a lot for giving me the chance, and he was definitely the only option for a professional contract this year. I mean, it might have been some lower levels, but not full-fledged professional, you know. I'm just glad I got the chance, and I have to prove it, you know.
Yeah, I'm reading the quote on the website from the press release yesterday where he refers to you as being their little secret, and adding you to their sprint team was a no-brainer. So that'll give you a great boost. What did the next couple of weeks entail? Is there any chance to rest the muscles after Glasgow, or is it straight into preparing for this adaptation?
Well, this week for me is just get, you know, come home, see people, rest up, you know, and then next week I'll get back in the bike, and or even the end of this week, and just start with the endurance side of it, you know, and focusing on that. I want the team's first training camps in a few weeks over in the States, so I need to be fit for that, you know. I don't want to show up in a horrible state and show myself up, so that's obviously put a bit of pressure on myself to kind of not be the worst with the camp.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting way of looking at it. But before I let you go, Philip Deignan has obviously signed up. He's heading into the second year of his contract with the squad. Does it help you that there's another Irishman within there, and have you spoken to him about what to expect?
I haven't spoken to him, but fairness to him, he sent me a message when you know, it was on the grapevine, you know, when the news went out, kind of in the cycling bubble first. And it was nice of him to kind of send me a message. So I think, I know Philip, you know, on and off the past few years, so it'd be good to kind of race with him, train with him, see how he works, because he's world class, you know. So I will definitely learn a few things off him.
Good stuff. Well, we wish you well. We'll follow your progress. And Martin, thanks for joining us on the programme.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks very much.
It's a history lesson to finish the programme this evening. The English Football Association, the oldest in the world, is closing in on its 150th anniversary. The game itself, obviously in various form, predates the FA, and some insight into its history can be garnered through a brilliant new anthology of football writing from newspapers of the Victorian era. Goalpost Victorian Football is edited by Paul Brown. He's trawled through what material exists, and it might surprise people that quite a considerable wealth of writing still lives on.
Yeah, certainly. I think that as football became more and more popular, I think that newspapers realised that in order to get that readership, they had to increase their football coverage. And there were an awful lot of newspapers in those times, obviously, because newspapers really were the only media outlet. There was no radio, obviously no TV. So if you wanted to know how your football team had done and you weren't actually at the match, the only way that you were going to find out the score was to read about it in the newspaper. So newspaper coverage was very important, and it was very popular in Victorian times.
And these then became the definitive sources of information, or the definitive accounts of matches. Maybe rightly or wrongly, we didn't have any of the video replays and everything that get broadcasters like me into trouble nowadays.
Well, that's right, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't any controversy, because obviously a newspaper report is coming from one person's point of view. Initially, a lot of newspaper match reports were actually submitted by club secretaries, so they would be biased in favour of their own team, and usually the following week in the letters column there would be a little bit of an argument about the previous week's report. And even when match reports were written by professional journalists, there was controversy. And one in particular that is featured in Goalpost involved a match involving Newton Heath, which it was the club that is now Manchester United. And what happened was they played West Bromwich Albion in 1894. And the Birmingham Gazette wrote a match report, and the reporter for the Birmingham Gazette accused Newton Heath's players of improper play, and he said it was not football, it was simply brutality. And he accused them of various dirty tricks, including kicking West Brom players in the head and in the back. West Brom were reduced to, I think, 9 men because of injuries. And Newton Heath were so aggrieved by this match report that they actually sued the Birmingham Gazette for libel, which is something that you just wouldn't expect a major football club to do these days, certainly. But back then, it happened, and it kind of set a bit of a legal precedent, really, because Newton Heath, although they actually won the libel case, the judge thought that the case was actually a bit of a waste of time, and he only awarded them one farthing in damages, which is kind of the lowest denomination of coin that they had then. And his judgment there kind of made sure that no football club in the future, right the way up to the present day, would really sue a newspaper due to a match report.
But we speak in 2012 when Leeds United, for example, have banned journalists from Elland Road. I think the local newspaper in Southampton is banned from St Mary's because of items they've published about the club. They're not the only parallels roused between the media and clubs that exist all these years later. There's notable incidents of disputes over scores and disputes over refereeing decisions to be read as well.
Certainly, refereeing decisions in particular. There's an account written by a referee who remains anonymous for reasons that become obvious when you read the piece. And it was written in 1893. And the piece is called How Referees Are Tricked. And basically, it's an account of how players would, for example, one particular trick that they used was that in those days there were no goal nets. So if the ball went just inside the goalpost, the defending team would quickly grab the ball, place it down for a goal kick and pretend that the ball hadn't gone in and that it wasn't a goal. And also the attacking team, if the ball had went just outside the post, they would appeal for the goal in the hope that that the referee would not have correctly seen it and would give the goal. So there were all sorts of little cheats, and a player remarked to this referee, nothing is lost by appealing. So it was actually a sort of tactic of players at that time to appeal for decisions.
And, you know, the gentlemanly game was not always gentlemanly. There's stories as well, and you reproduce accounts of unruly supporters and perhaps some conflict between players and fans.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it hooliganism, but there is an account of a team travelling around the country. The team is actually Notts County, and it's an account by a club reporter who follows them all around the country. And he does remark that when they arrive, usually by train in various towns, that the home supporters will form a sort of guard of honour and pick on the sort of weak-looking members of the squad, and they'll shout particular abuse and songs at them, and which I suppose still goes on every week today. But it's just again another little illustration that a lot of the issues that we think of as belonging to modern football actually have been along for quite a long time, to be honest.
But there are differences as well, and if a game from the Victorian era was to be reproduced now, tactically it would look very, very different. But even the number of players on the field and the rules of the game were completely different.
Well, there were certainly at the beginning of association football. I mean, the Football Association basically was formed in 1863, and the first association football match was played in January 1864, and it took place in Battersea Park in London, and it was played between two representative sides. One was the president's side, the president of the Football Association, and one was the secretary's side. And it would have looked very different because, for a start, the two teams had 14 players on each side, so it was 14 a side. There were no goalkeepers, and perhaps most interestingly, any player was allowed to catch the ball. They weren't allowed to run with the ball in the hands, and they weren't allowed to throw the ball or pass the ball with the hands. If they caught the ball, they had to set it down and take a free kick. But basically, everyone on the pitch was allowed to catch the ball, and that's kind of why there was no individual goalkeeper.
And it charts the development of the game from a kickabout amongst friends to more organised football, and you've accounts by C.W. Alcock, who would have been the secretary of the Football Association early on. Overall, how was football viewed, or could there have been any idea of how big and how global this game was going to become?
I really don't think so. I think that when even the Football Association, even when that was formed, it was basically formed by the captains of local teams. And the reason that they formed the Football Association was that each town, each public school, had their own set of rules. So, for example, Oxford or Cambridge couldn't play a team from, say, Sheffield, where there were a lot of football teams, simply because they played two different rules. And the reason for setting up the Football Association was really to codify the rules so that teams from different towns and different universities and public schools could get together and could play each other. And that's what happened. But there are also a couple of accounts in the book of a time slightly before that where they were trying to bring together the rules unsuccessfully. And it wasn't until this meeting of the captains that happened in 1863 that the Football Association was formed and the rules, the laws of the game were hammered out.
Is this going to be the first of a couple of volumes of anthologies? Because as you've touched on, there must be such a depth of information that it's quite hard to rein yourself back in and just select the chosen few for the book.
Well, there is, and it would be hoped, let's see how this one goes down, but it would be hoped that we could put out some more because I already have selected enough for another couple of volumes because, as you say, the wealth of material is really fantastic. And in this first edition, I didn't want to put in all of the most obvious pieces, you know, so all the cup finals, all the international matches, that sort of thing. So I've tried to kind of provide a sort of mixture of, there are some important games featured in the book, but also just a mixture to kind of give a general picture of what it must have been like to have watched football at that time. And hopefully if this first volume goes down well, then we'll be able to put out a second volume and put some more of this really valuable information and entertaining information in there as well.
I must say it's a fascinating read, and anyone who's into history or into sport or even into the history of sport, certainly to combine the two, will really enjoy it. If people want to get their hands on the book, Paul, what's the best way to go about it?
Well, it should be available from most online bookstores, but also there's a website that you can go to for information and links, and the website is victorianfootball.co.uk.
Paul, it's a great read. Best of luck with it, and thanks for joining us on the programme.
Thanks a lot, Damien. Thanks.
Sport at 7 on RTE Radio 1, in association with AIB, supporting clubs, supporting communities.